Whoa. We got to get these doggies. They're out of the pen. We got to get them back in the pen.
In the pen, sure.
In the pen. We
got
to get them over to the Last Podcast Network Country Jamboree, June 18th, 2022, at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, Tennessee.
Come and check out all the shows that you love on the Last Podcast Network. We'll be in front of you in our meet space, and we cannot wait to entertain you and have a great time.
But for those of you that can't come in person, go to momenthouse.com/LPOTL and buy your live stream ticket. Yes, you too can watch us perform our jangly country jamboree from the nudity of your couch.
Absolutely fantastic. I hope you guys enjoy the show. Thank you so much for your support, and we are so excited to be at the OG Grand Old Opry.
Yeah!
Hail yourselves!
There's no place to escape to.
This is the Last
Podcast.
On the left.
Right from your glaze.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
Oh, yeah! You ready?
Why are you making weird baby noises? That's how you want to open the show? That's not even content. That's not jokes. It's not a character. You're just saying garbage into the microphone. It's just huge ass ASMR.
I got it.
Is this the beginning of the show?
It could be.
It has to be.
Oh, we have a time crunch. Woo. I made it.
I guess you did.
Welcome to the Last Podcast on the Left, everyone. I'm Ben, hanging out with Henry and Marcus. Hope everyone is doing well out there. Today, we are on to part two of the love story between Leopold and Loeb.
I have a question up top. I want to maybe, as we do the episode, I would like to maybe see if we can answer. Or maybe okay. We can address as we go.
Sure.
Why do two rich boys, and this is common. I was watching a Dateline last night. Same thing. Mm-hmm. Rich kid who wanted to become a killer and commit the perfect crime.
Ugh,
right?
God, mm-hmm. So annoying.
That's the concept. Right? And it's same thing as Leopold and Loeb. It's these two, like, the little teeny tiny pre-Ubermensches.
Was this the kids who pretended to be, like, Ghostface from Scream? And then they filmed themselves. And then after they'd committed the murder, they were like, Oh no.
Well, this is specifically socioeconomic factors mixed with like a type of intelligence, right? Like high level intelligent little kids who want to do the perfect crime, but they fuck it up, even though they have all of these resources and all these trainings, and all they do is fuck it up in the, the most immediate way possible.
To be honest, it's not easy.
But why then do drooling psychopaths or people bent with like the fervent hallucinations, people like Jeffrey Dahmer, Ed Gein, they are able to have criminal careers that last for decades? Why is it that, what's the deal?
What's the deal?
Well, I think this is a question that will better be answered in episode 3 when we truly get into the psychology of Leopold and Loeb, as was laid out by their defense lawyer. But I think a lot of it does have to do with the socioeconomic status of the victims of the crime. And I would also say that we are talking about Leopold and Loeb because they were caught. And I would imagine there are quite a few rich kids who did these sorts of murders and got away scot-free.
Barron Trump.
I know. Barron Trump is 6'7", technically the most innocent Trump at this point. I will say this. It's because they wanted a spanking.
I guess that's what it is. They wanted to be naughty.
Yeah.
So when we last left Leopold and Loeb, the body of their murder victim, Bobby Franks, had just been found by pump workers in a drainage pipe at Wolf Lake, where Leopold and Loeb had stuffed the body just hours before.
Making manicotti!
Whoa!
This discovery was extraordinarily bad for Leopold and Loeb's plan, because in order for their kidnapping scheme to work, the Franks family had to believe that their son was still alive. see Leopold and Loeb, but believed that they were such master criminals so as to render the body impossible to find. Mm. And their backup plan is that even if it was found, the body would never be identified because they'd so ingeniously poured hydrochloric acid on the face and the genitals.
It's just really sad how ironically possible it was to find.
It really...
They put it in somebody's workplace. They may as well have just laid it on the buffet table in a Ponderosa.
Yeah, they didn't do it. And this is where I feel like the concept of the Ubermensch plays into it as well. Like this idea that they believe that they were so superior, you know, and that they had already committed the perfect crime. It's not that they were, in fact, in the middle of committing the perfect crime, is that they've already done it. And then there's no way anybody could possibly follow up on anything that they're doing.
Right.
I think it's also a little bit of a case of rich kid laziness and rich kid arrogance.
What I mean. That's the Ubermensch. It's the flaw of the Ubermensch, quote unquote.
But I think it's not like Ubermensch is giving it way too much credit. I think it's much more mundane than that.
I'm saying it in a sarcasm font.
Yeah, because I think because with them, they could have very easily moved the body to a different place because they got to the, remember, they got to the drainage pipe and they found that the drainage pipe was too small to fit the body. Because remember, they had also switched victims at the last moment. They had a whole list of victims of people that could fit into the pipe and they switched. Let's do Bobby instead and never thought, Bobby's might be too big for the drainage pipe, but they were too lazy to find another place. And even though Bobby's feet were sticking out of the drainage pipe, they still said, fuck it, let's go home, whatever.
Yeah, we did it. But we do know that actually you can't just pour acid on a body and dissolve it. I looked it up. There's a serial killer, John George Haig. He used sulfuric acid to dissolve bodies. But what you have to do is you have to completely submerge them
in a
barrel. And it took 2 days to melt the body.
And that sulfuric acid. Leopold and Loeb didn't use sulfuric acid to try and melt the body's face. They used hydrochloric acid. And all the hydrochloric acid did was brown out part of Bobby Franks's face. It looks just like a dark birthmark.
Yeah,
and we all know, genitals are not usually a part of the body identification process, no matter what Nathan Leopold had heard.
I bet you there's a couple of them that I would identify.
Yeah, I think that if you saw mine, you'd be like, is that the mayor of Whoville?
Whoa, oh my.
It curls up.
I'm taking care of my little brother. He's my wonderful little man. And I have to say this, I'm totally coming around to being a little chunky if you have a kid, and then also video games, because you know they're too chunky to kidnap, and then also you know exactly where they are because they're playing video games. So what I'm saying
wait
is Leopold and Loeb,
if
there was video games, they would have probably not killed anybody, and also this kid wouldn't have even been on the streets. Therefore, everyone needs to gain more weight and play more games.
First of all, this is an old school, this is a Louis Anderson bit.
No.
About being fat makes you harder to kidnap, I believe.
Yeah, and you're also, all you're doing is you're advocating for the future, the dystopian future, by the way, that is portrayed in the movie WALL-E.
That's what he wants.
WALL-E. Yeah,
that's his ultimate expression of
WALL-E.
Freedom. But this week on Side Stories, he's pro-slave labor.
No, I was not. He's pro-slave labor. Not.
He said it.
No, I did not.
You said that it was good for the environment.
No, I did not say that. You were talking about Conan the Barbarian, and I said, well, at the very least, he was a man. He wasn't a machine, and it was healthier to have Conan move your wheels than if it was a big robot. And then I also said dementia might help you from not getting kidnapped, because if you don't know where you're going, no one knows where you are. That's all.
It means nothing.
Broke clock is right 6 times.
Yeah, that's what I say. None of it's real.
But even so, on the morning after Leopold and Loeb kidnapped Bobby Franks, neither Leopold, Loeb, nor the Franks family knew that Bobby Franks was dead, although the Franks did know that Bobby had been kidnapped.
Mm.
See, if you'll remember, on the night of the kidnapping, Leopold and Loeb had crammed into a telephone booth together They called the Franks' house to tell them that their son had been kidnapped. And as a result, Bobby Franks' father, Jacob Franks, was in the process of putting together $10,000 in cash to pay the ransom the next morning.
Do you think when Leopold and Loeb were first going to drive around scouting for victims that it was kind of fun for them to play being poor? Do you think they were like, hey, Leopold, what if we get this? What if we went and ate lunch at a rallies? What if we did it?
I'm just realizing Superman used to change clothes in a booth, but he was faster than a speeding bullet. Couldn't he have just done it in plain sight and we wouldn't have even noticed?
It's a fictional device, and you are a huge fucking moron.
All right. fantastic. I know you. Yeah, I know you're out of things to say when you just become negative.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Then Clark Kent is just standing there, and then suddenly Superman is standing in the exact same place.
Yeah.
So
exactly,
it would be very obvious that Clark Kent is Superman.
Right now, his disguise is the lack of glasses.
It is truly already very obvious that Clark Kent is Superman, but
yeah.
I think that's part of his powers.
Well, we all know the only reason that no one thought Superman was Clark Kent is because no one thinks Superman can read. All right. He's not from around here.
He's not from around here.
Hey, you're from around. We could have just bullied Superman. To leave. You're from around here.
Yeah, oh, no.
Why didn't Lex Luthor ever try that?
Nah, he's trying to laugh at there. Oh, what do? You try to kiss me? You try to kiss me? Please kiss me. You try to kiss me? Come on.
All Lex Luthor ever did was try to play on the xenophobia of Superman's alienness.
You see again, man?
Yeah.
He's what is going on?
Long live long enough to see himself become the villain.
Uh-huh.
But even though Bobby Franks' body hadn't yet been identified, news of a naked dead boy found in a drainage pipe traveled fast, and the story was published in the afternoon edition of the Chicago Daily News.
New dead boy. Yeah, excellent. Yes. Yes. We'll put this right in front of Garfield.
I bet you Garfield was around. Were there newsies in this era? Was this news?
Yeah, oh, this news is the golden age of newsies, my friend.
So if you're a newsie, this news must have hit hard that day because it's one of your people.
Oh, yeah. You're like, no, John. Well, honestly, I feel like it's kind of nice because it's less competition.
Oh, good.
For your roots.
Okay.
Yeah, you're like, yeah, fuck yeah, another weak child gone. This is my streets. This is my town.
And when the naked dead boy story hit, someone told the Franks' family lawyer that someone should go down to the morgue to see if the naked dead boy was Bobby.
Oh,
so
God.
Bobby's uncle went, and after he identified the body, Jacob Franks was told that his son was dead.
And sadly, his uncle did identify the body solely by its genitals. And this just leads to more questions than answers, and I don't like what's happening here.
You know what I also appreciate this time period is that the father never had experienced trauma other than the war. As that he just had
trauma, though.
All he had to do was go to the war, and then he came back, and he never had to see or hear an unpleasant thing ever again. He had to go work. Obviously, he was doing unpleasant things because he was running Sears Roebuck or whatever at the point, which one of these was.
No. Sears, the guy who ran Sears Roebuck, that was Richard Loeb's father.
Either way, they're businessmen.
Okay.
And so they're already making terrible decisions, but right. They don't see it, yeah. Right? And yeah. So, just sending the lawyer to go look at your son's body, and he's like, all right, okay. Or is he just happy? He's like, yes.
Wow, well, the brutal. Reason why is because they didn't want to upset the mother, Flora. Sure. Like,
of
they didn't
course.
Want to say, they didn't want Flora to know, like, because if it turned out that it wasn't his body, then there would be no reason to upset Flora. So it's like, why don't you go take care of this? And he called him up and said, I got some bad news.
And every single time she gets upset, she squirts webs out of her cloaca, which is why they hate cleaning up. Because honestly, some of those big sized human mother webs are incredibly strong.
So you just feel like this would be the time for you to demean the mother of a victim.
It was 100 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, therefore, it's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
But just after Franks was told the news, when he was still in shock, Leopold and Loeb called the Franks house with further instructions. They said, quote,
Hey there, this is George Johnson speaking.
Yeah, good.
Good white name.
Yeah, good white, yeah.
There will be a yellow cab at your door in 10 minutes. Get into it and proceed immediately to the drugstore at 1465 East 63rd Street.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah, got you. You fucking asshole. You fucking... give me a picture of your butt. Bring a picture of your butt.
Your feet smell like radishes. Okay, good.
But since Jacob already knew that his son was dead...
Oh.
Franks just walked outside when the yellow cab pulled up and paid the man for his troubles, then sent him on his way.
I've already seen a dead boy this morning.
Oh, a horrible day.
In the meantime, though, Leopold and Loeb believed that their plan was on a solid track, so they continued the setup of the elaborate ransom delivery plan that we discussed last week.
It's a project!
I guess. Didn't they hear the news that everyone else heard the news that there was a dead boy?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's the thing. Just as they were putting the final touches on their master scheme, they happened to walk past a newsstand that featured an unmissable headline that said something along the lines of, naked boy found in drain pipe.
But wait a second.
Do you think that's
what if that's not our
there might be another one.
Naked boy?
Oh,
because
God.
There was Wolf. That naked boy parade.
That's
but I think
right.
that was just at the Clemensons' home.
Mm,
and yeah, they were choosing a new son.
Oh,
but you know that all of those boys get scattered to the orphan holds.
Right.
Now, Richard figured, hey, there's no point in continuing all this if the body has already been found.
Now it's ruined.
They ruined it.
But Nathan figured, hey, maybe they haven't identified the dead naked boy yet. But when Jacob Franks didn't show up at the drugstore from the yellow cab they sent, Nathan conceded that the plan was kaput.
You can see this, him in the car just like, fucking goddamn, fuck.
Yeah. So both of them went to their respective homes at around 4 p.m. with full knowledge that they'd fucked up their perfect crime.
Not a perfect crime anymore, Leopold.
No, it's really not. No, it's not, Loeb.
Hey, the way you said that made me fucking horny. Don't you fuck around with me. You have sex with me. You backscuttle me. That's another term I found for 1920s for gay men. Backscuttlers.
Very fun.
Backscuttlers. Wow, yeah, backscuttling.
And it's all about, I think it's about getting down on your hands and knees and crawling backwards like a fucked up crab.
Well, have a good time with it. Also, Henry informed me that in the early 1900s, heterosexuality was defined, and it was actually originally defined as a disgusting love of women.
An abnormal and excessive fascination with the opposite sex. That's how it was defined in 1901.
Interesting. You know, my favorite euphemism has always been the beast with two backs.
Oh, yeah. Whoa. Yeah, because, I mean, honestly, though, I thought ass to ass wasn't invented until 2001 in Requiem for a Dream.
Oh, no, that's just when it got monetized and put on the big screen.
Pre-9/11, man, the world was simpler.
Yeah. Requiem for a Dream was not simple. It was quite complex.
I know,
and horrible.
But it actually was very simple. All they wanted was heroin.
Yeah, but it's tough to get.
Yeah, and I'm sure there were people taking devices and putting them in each other's asses and going back and forth and back and forth.
Oh my God. Before
decades,
the first,
centuries, millennium.
Before the first person defecated, they were jamming something in there.
I actually also had a listener email say that the first instance of a blowjob ever depicted was in a hieroglyph.
Wow.
Yeah, man. We've been sucking dick since the fucking weed crawled out of the river.
People have been horny forever, and people have had blue senses of humor because Henry, this is actually, I'm giving you two compliments here. He also informed me the first joke of all time involved a woman farting on somebody's cock.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
And great.
There you go. And chimps blow each other, right?
Oh, yeah. Every creature.
Every animal blows each other.
Dolphins are known to have sex with one. I did read that they have sex with inanimate objects for pleasure alone. Like, there was one example of a dolphin fucking a beheaded fish. Like, he just stuck it on his dick like a little fleshlight that wiggled around and shit.
Okay.
Well, back to the story, huh?
All right. Yeah. Fantastic.
Now, naturally, a story about a dead boy mangled and stuffed in a drainage pipe was big news. And even though it hadn't yet been announced that the victim was a society boy, the Leopold House was still a Twitter with the newest true crime story of the day.
Time to ring the naked boy bell. Ding, 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 ding. We did it again.
Now, all this gossip made Nathan a little uncomfortable, so he went out for a walk. And outside, he ran into his English teacher, Mott Mitchell, who coincidentally would soon become a suspect in the Bobby Franks murder himself.
Oh.
Well, Mott had heard that the victim had been identified as Bobby Franks. But Nathan, of course, denied knowing the boy.
I don't know that boy. And he's like, I didn't ask you. I didn't know him. That's
I didn't
saying.
Kill him. No,
and I won't kill him, and I won't kill again.
Okay, fantastic. Weird conversation. I'm just going to go.
And I certainly won't kill you. In a perfect crime.
Well, by definition, it's no longer perfect because you just threatened me with death.
Unless I then do it without being caught, then it is the most perfect crime.
I was a horrible teacher to you, and I'm sorry I didn't teach you anything about morality.
I wish you had reached out to me.
I know.
Yeah. Actually, I think they might have blown each other, but we'll get to that later.
Whoa, maybe. Wow.
Man, that's how it is, man.
The Queen's English.
Back scuttling is back in fashion.
Oh, mamacita.
Richard Loeb, meanwhile, who was a different kind of sociopath, he reveled in the story. He discussed it at length with a few college buddies who were all journalism students at the University of Chicago. This is the next day.
Do you think that one of the killers was blonde? I don't know, because I've heard that one of the killers was impossibly handsome.
You the killer man?
I wish I was.
Okay.
Now, one of these college students, one of these buddies, was an actual student journalist for the school newspaper. And he noted that Richard Loeb seemed to have an insider's view of the murder. Now, this wasn't immediately a red flag because Richard Loeb was Bobby's second cousin after all. Well, when Richard took the journalism students to the drugstore where Jacob Franks was supposed to contact the kidnappers to impress his friends with a location scoop, it was noted again that maybe Richard knew a little bit too much about this case.
Yeah, he's just real into it in a way, in almost a psychic fashion.
Yeah, man. I mean, the smoking man from that fantastic television show that we all know and love.
The X-Files?
No, I wanted to see what he thought it was.
Okay, yeah, what did you think it was?
blumpering the bitch.
Now he's just making it up. Now I know he's
no. But I'm saying is usually the deep throat isn't also the perpetrator.
Sure.
Is what I'm saying.
Yes.
Yeah, they're not supposed to. No.
Well, furthermore, Richard seemed to both brag about being Bobby's second cousin while also maligning him. Richard called Bobby an arrogant, selfish, spoiled boy, and he even went so far as to say that if he was gonna murder anybody...
And I mean anybody!
Anybody.
Bobby was just the kind of, quote, cocky little son of a bitch he'd pick.
He was just recently five or six? How old is he?
He was 14.
Oh, yeah, he could be cocky, I guess, but
sure, it doesn't matter, he's 14.
Yeah. But strangely, though, this statement didn't raise any eyebrows because I suppose it was just chalked up to Richard just being Richard.
That's the thing.
I don't think these guys are very good at being journalists.
Well, the asshole part of it kind of blends the whole thing together because he acted in character as it was.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Live from your grave.
A roast as dark as the night, perfect for fueling the cryptid research and mad ravings required for your podcasting. Don't mind the red eyes. He's just trying to warn you of the bridge.
The bridge.
Finally, from the caffeine-addled brains of Springheel Jack Coffee and Last Podcast on the Left, we bring you Mothman's Red Eye Blend. Yes, delicious Panama beans. Go to lastpodcastmerch.com to order yours today.
Now, once the murder of Bobby Franks became big news, the Chicago police chief held a press conference and made the murder sound much more heinous than it actually was, calling it one of the most brutal murders the Chicago PD had ever come across. Now, that's absolutely not true.
No.
Because remember, H.H. Holmes wasn't that long ago when it comes to Chicago.
Yeah, they had other ones. But you had a good reason for it. I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, even though Bobby Franks was murdered, the 1919 rape and murder of a Chicago six-year-old named Janet Wilkinson had been far worse. And that's not even counting the hundreds of gangland slayings that had drowned Chicago in blood since Prohibition began.
When I was doing a little bit of research on the rise of the mafia in Chicago, it really is kind of wild how many mass murders took place. And because again, it's in the past, which is like, you know, I jokingly said it's fun to make fun of the woman because 100 years ago.
Well, they would be dead now anyway.
Looking back in time at that time period, it was an active land war happening in Chicago.
Right.
That they were currently also fighting. So they're fighting this land war kind of against themselves because they're also slowly but surely the cops are, which we'll see is a trend, are becoming the mafia in Chicago, and that war is tearing the city apart as well.
Mm-hmm. Great food city, though.
Oh, yeah. Great. That's how you get it. City. When you combine mafia and cops, that's actually how you get good food.
Yeah. But making this murder seem bigger than it was the entire point. A big, stinky murder that wasn't of the gangland persuasion distracted the public from how bad of a job the Chicago police were doing enforcing prohibition. And it distracted from just how many gangland murders had gone unsolved or prevented by said police. In addition, the new mayor of Chicago, William Deaver, had campaigned on ending the trade of illegal liquor in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But at this point in history, Chicago was nevertheless rapidly becoming the property of one Al Capone.
I just see these guys saying, like, we are definitely going to stop the flow of that heinous devil alcohol through the city. Meanwhile, like, you could just see the whiskey soaked in their mustache.
Absolutely.
Like, brown liquid just goes down their chin.
That's what I was thinking as well. If you're a police officer, a detective, anyone who works in homicide, I mean, the death rates are so high. If they don't have alcohol, they're just going to end up killing people also. Like, I feel like, what else do you do to unwind when you're a hardened detective?
Prohibition was a massive mistake.
Oh, you think it was a mistake?
Yeah, it was. And it actually cemented a massive, the corrupt angle of many local governments. And it's never left.
I'm just so happy you're getting political.
I mean, this is as far as I go.
No, absolutely. And this is also during this time, Al Capone was not quite yet a boss. This is more like the time of Johnny Torrio. But this was around the time that it started transitioning from Torrio over into Capone.
And that was the bloodiest transition because Torrio was the guy who did everything. you got to be able to have conversations. You got to be able. It was all peaceful. So it was all like, this is business. This isn't a war. We got to look out each for each other. And Al Capone's like, hey, I'll kill everybody. Yeah. Because he just wanted to be in charge.
It's pretty cool. City is eating itself. I am vengeance. He does remind me of the Penguin's origin story the Batman. And am I sexually attracted to Robert Pattinson? Yes.
Yeah, because he's
So to distract from all that, cops focused on high profile crimes that could be solved or at least closed. You know, those are two very different things.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And they investigated the murder of Bobby Franks with a vigorous helping of police brutality and unconstitutional behavior to speed the process along.
Hey, Detective Peterson, come over here. You see this case file that's open?
Yeah, yep.
See, no, it's not solved, right?
Yeah, no. This is incredible because I'm new to the force.
See what I'm doing here with my hands?
Yep. Whoa, you're just closing it with your hands like that.
I just closed it. And now you see this little file here?
Whoa, you put it
right in there.
Whoa, and we just...
Case closed.
We just solved the crime?
Let's go get hammered.
Whoa, that's incredible. Whoa! Yeah, let's go get, quote unquote, some medicine liquid from the pharmacist.
Fantastic.
Now, the first suspect pool for the Bobby Franks murder was the faculty of the Harvard School for Boys. So the day after the body was identified, investigators rounded up and roughly interrogated every instructor in the school using everything from unlawful imprisonment to rubber hose beating.
I looked up how they beat you up with the rubber hose, like what they do. Mm-hmm. So the idea at the time was that it would be inappropriate to leave bruises on their face.
Oh, I see.
And because at the time, police brutality was, and
you're more humble.
It was frowned upon.
Okay.
But it was considered an active interrogation tactic. Okay. I mean, different from now, obviously. Definitely.
Definitely different.
Yeah. They don't do this anymore at all.
No, they don't just kill you.
But the idea that police brutality was considered a part of the normal interrogation process. So what they wanted to do was that they couldn't put you on the stand with bruises on your face because then we're all like, okay, who did it? And then they'll find out. But so they would do is they'd fill a rubber hose, a piece of industrial, like a length of it, like 3 feet in length. They'd fill it with dirt. And then they'd cordon off the two sides of it and then just beat the ever-living fuck out of you. And they said that it didn't cause bruises, but...
A homemade billy club.
I don't know, man. I don't know. I feel like it might bruise very easily.
What's kind of interesting about this is the teachers at this all-boys school, you know for a fact there's at least 5% pedophiles in there, so at least they got a scare that day.
You are literally saying talking points from the chief of the Chicago police.
Yes, you are.
They did it.
This guy, he's a good guy. I like this guy.
You very much are. But you're definitely still on that everyone's a pedophile train.
No, I said 5%. I said 5%. Wow. 95% not pedophile. Look on the bright side, guys.
Now, the reasoning for going after teachers first was threefold. First, every teacher knew Bobby Franks and knew that Jacob Franks was rich, so it could be safely assumed that the $10,000 ransom would be paid. Second, $10,000 was more than 5 years' salary for an instructor at the Harvard School for Boys, which gave ample motive.
Oh, yes.
But lastly, and most importantly for the future of the investigation, the ransom note was so well written that it was correctly surmised that only a highly educated snoot box could have written it, which narrowed the suspect pool in Prohibition-era Chicago considerably.
And honestly, if you do read the ransom note, we covered it a little bit last week, but I'll read this last little paragraph to you see what they're talking about. As a final word of warning, this is a strictly commercial proposition, and we are prepared to put our threat into execution should we have reasonable grounds to believe that you have committed an infraction of the above instructions. However, should you carefully follow out your instructions to the letter, we can assure you that your son will safely be returned to you within 6 hours of our receipt of the money. But it's very, there's no like gunk on it. No. There ain't no stank on it. There's no like other
there's
people.
No
there's, like, there's no fat cats. There's no Dorner list of shout outs. Like there's nothing like there's nothing fun in it. And it was again, they thought that like, well, obviously some stuffed shirt asshole wrote this.
Don't corner the Dorner. Also, did you say receipt?
Yes, on purpose. I didn't.
And there was no spelling mistakes whatsoever.
None.
So they thought this absolutely has to be an educated person.
Spelled Beverly wrong.
And additionally, Jacob Frank's address had been handwritten on the envelope containing the first ransom letter. And the penmanship obviously suggested that it came from a capable, educated hand.
Dearest, all yours. Forever yours.
Nathan Leopold George Jackson.
This also shows, actually, ironically, a level of stupidity. They should have dumbed it down, perhaps, if they didn't want people to know what kind of class they belong to.
Well, that's why from now on, everybody does it. Now they know. You don't, you have, that's why they purposely misspell things. It is all about throwing cops off your trail.
Okay.
Well, in the beginning, this information placed the focus of the investigation on the instructors at the Harvard Boys School. And while, yes, some had engaged in suspicious activity.
What the fuck were you just yelling at me for?
Listen, let me finish. Suspicious activity when looked through the lens of a child murder investigation.
That's the thing.
Most of these men were just teachers and were unfairly maligned. Most
probably 95% were unfairly maligned. How much were not? How many were not, Mr. Parks?
Well, you're still on the pedophile train.
Okay. Okay. Sorry, 5% of the teachers at this boys' school are.
Sometimes a false flag is still a flag. No. You know what I mean? Then like, there is a flag happening.
It's a truth flag.
Well, the only thing that I argue with is that you say that just because somebody works at a boys' school, it means that they're more likely to be a pedophile than not. And that's what I take
issue
with.
Honestly, it doesn't make them less likely. If you work at a Burger King, odds are you eat more Burger King. So the fact of the matter is...
Yeah, you have access to boys.
Exactly.
That's the thing. It's where the pile of boys are.
I am calling false equivalency, sir. False equivalency. Hamburgers are not boys. Anuses.
I don't know. Have you ever put a boy between two buns?
All right. It's an idiot sandwich. Yes. Gordon Ramsay.
As far as being unfairly maligned, let's start with a math teacher named Walter Wilson. Walter Wilson had once taken the Franks children on an excursion to Riverside and hadn't returned with the boys until 1 a.m. But there wasn't anything untoward about the late arrival.
No, at least that's what the cop said. He was probably just hammered. And weird.
I don't remember hanging out with my math teacher till 1 a.m., but okay.
But sometimes, I hung out with my history teacher for like 3 days in the swap house. Honestly, all we really did was watch old Flintstones cartoons while I watched him do bong rips, and he just said, don't leave, don't leave, don't leave, you're my wife now. But the whole time, I was just like, well, when are we fucking?
Oh, I see. You flipped it. Yeah.
But since Wilson didn't even have a girlfriend, much less a wife, and since he didn't know any young ladies in Chicago, police assumed he was a pedophile.
How many times have you hung out with an 8-year-old till 1 a.m.?
I mean...
How many times? That isn't your child.
I don't even want a child.
But that's the thing. But if he had a wife, they would have said, no, totally fine, totally cool. He was probably just gay, or he had bad luck with the ladies.
He's weird. He lost his watch.
Yeah. Who knows?
I found it inside Bobby.
Oh, mama.
Well, this accusation of pedophilia was also assumed of athletics coach Richard Williams and English teacher Mott Mitchell, the latter of which had spoken to Nathan Leopold the day of the murder. Both Williams and Mitchell were questioned for 5 hours by police, who beat them with a rubber hose to elicit a confession.
But dog meat again, you say this with such derision. They had to sign a paper after confessing, saying that the confession was completely of their own choice.
Right.
And that's where you don't understand that the rubber hose,
it
just leads them to the conversation.
Right.
Like an hors d'oeuvre.
Oh, I see.
Like a cocktail hour at a wedding.
Oh, that is always nice.
However, I will concede that these two were a little more suspicious than the others. I'll concede that. It sounds like a buddy, regular old Jerry Sandusky over here. I'll concede that. See, Williams had come under scrutiny because police had found an unknown brown liquid in his home.
Yeah, I keep shit in a jar. You got a problem with it? I'm an American. I fought in World War One.
One.
Whose shit is it? Okay.
Once it's shit, it belongs to everybody.
Oh, is that right?
Oh yeah, man. This is everybody. This is
fucking feces is public domain.
That's public domain, right? I don't need a copyright to keep a jar of shit in my home.
Oh, like Winnie the Pooh.
Well, this related to the Franks murder because, if you'll remember, while Leopold and Loeb believed they could disfigure the corpse's face beyond recognition with hydrochloric acid, the caustic chemical just sort of stained it brown. The part about it that was a little suspicious, and remember, this was common practice at the time.
Why are you defending these two pedophiles?
I'm not defending pedophiles. I'm defending your...
I'm defending 5%.
Innocent until proven
guilty, and we have to have due process.
I'm just saying that you throw around the pedophile accusation a little too freely.
I said 5%.
But this brown liquid was a lotion that Williams rubbed into his student's muscles after vigorous exercise.
This is he's a coach, okay?
Oh, he's a coach?
And you know him. He's a coach.
So I said something accurate 20 minutes ago, and then you have completely agreed with me, but somehow you're saying I'm wrong.
I did not completely agree with you at all. You're saying 5%. You don't even know how many teachers were at this school. So how are you doing these percentages, sir? Where is your calculator? Show your math. Show your math.
I'm going to step in and say, Dog Meat, he's obviously not crunching the numbers. But there was kernel of truth. And again, and this does then feature into, and I'm not going to, again, I'm with Kissel, I'm not going to give him the broken clock saying. I'm not going to say that he's correct either. But technically, in a way, Kissel is being the allegorical broken clock currently.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ben, if 5% of people who teach at boys' schools are pedophiles, who are we going to get to teach all these boys?
95% of the other teachers.
We just need more disciplined pedophiles that know to keep their hands to themselves. Because then they love the work. Because they're really building these kids' minds. That's what I think. They just need more training.
Yeah. Well, Mott Mitchell, I will admit, he did edge much closer to pedophile territory. He did have a reputation for having sex with his teenage students. He did have that. There was that. But I'm not going to say that's 5%. I'm just saying it's one guy, one bad apple, Ben.
He's a coach.
Yeah.
He's trying to get him ready for scouting.
This is the teacher.
That's the English teacher. Yeah.
Ooh, he's got to stop calling himself a coach then. I don't know what he's using that whistle for.
Exactly.
And he also had a $10,000 mortgage, the exact amount that the kidnappers requested. But what removed both men from the suspect list, and all the teachers for that matter, was the fact that they had ironclad alibis for the night of Bobby Franks' murder. Despite that fact, though, state's attorney Robert Crow still thought that it was a teacher who done it. So Crow kept all of the teachers locked up for a week without warrants after convincing a judge that ignoring habeas corpus was necessary to solve the case.
And those kids, think about it, it's just school's out for the summer. Every teacher in the school is in jail. That's fucking freedom, dude. That's how the Foot Clan started.
Yeah, like, it
just
really
skateboard
is.
Skateboard ramps everywhere.
Sounds like a Far Side cartoon. Just 100 English teachers all in a cell.
Eating gummy bears for dinner, man. Who gives a shit, dude? Teachers are gone. Illegal to teach me.
But the nice thing is they didn't arrest any janitors because they know for a fact janitors are the purest people that work in schools.
I think a lot of them just died during the interrogation.
Could be.
So you're going to say that teachers are 5% pedophiles, but janitors are 100% A-OK?
We know for a fact the janitors are not.
Nope. A-OK. I'm team janitor all the way.
Then, even after the teachers were released, one investigator still went to the press to angrily maintain that one teacher had written the letter while another had murdered Bobby Franks. In other words, the police were flailing and figured that they could beat and intimidate their way towards a confession just to get the murder off the books, like oh so many cops have done before and after. Remember, kids, no lawyer, no talkie-talkie.
No talkie-talkie, especially if you're innocent.
And again, we open it up.
Oh, look at that. Oh, that's an open case. So much work. So much paperwork. It's closed now. What a relief.
Detective work.
Now, as far as other leads went, a 10-year-old child named Irving did come forward to say that he'd seen Bobby Franks on the day he was murdered talking to someone in a gray Witten automobile.
Mm.
But the 10-year-old said that when he turned away to look at some flowers, the Witten was already gone.
But maybe these teachers should be arrested because none of these kids have a span of attention. And honestly, they need to be able to pay attention to what's going on. This is really, more kids need to be taught how to do witness recollection.
Well, this is why I'm actually team Pokemon Go as well. Well, it gets the kids out of the house. They can find the bodies.
But
they
they're
pay
just looking
attention.
At their phones.
No, they're looking at reality through their phones, but they also see reality.
You're just building. Yeah. It's interesting because you have all these problems with AI, but you're just building the case for augmented reality.
In that one situation.
Now, much like the car in the Paul Bernardo case, where cops chased the wrong vehicle for far too long, everyone in a gray Witten in Chicago got constantly harassed until Leopold and Loeb were caught, to the point where some painted their cars a different color entirely.
Oh, yeah.
Now, it was assumed that Bobby Franks had been the victim of a child molester because the coroner hinted in his report that the boy had been molested because the rectum was dilated and could, quote, easily admit one middle finger.
Hey, man, at least it wasn't a thumb.
I don't know. I get, but the, oh, no, I don't want to think about it.
It's just the thing is that you're looking it up and they're like, hey, Jimmy, come over here. What kind of finger you think
yeah,
get in this thing?
Yeah, that could fit in there.
All right, how do I put this in the report? Should I say carrot? The edge of a cane?
I mean, I don't.
What should I put in here?
It's never a good day when you have to decipher what could fit in a, anyone, you know what I'm talking
in
about.
In a dead boy?
Yes.
Yeah. And that's the thing is that the middle finger, there's no difference between these three fingers as far as like diameter goes.
It's
just the middle finger is the longest one. So I guess do they
it just sounds like he went bowling that morning.
Yeah, just staring at my meat hooks. I think the pointer is actually the thickest.
You do. Yeah, it is big. Yeah. Well, at least it wasn't his dick and balls.
Yeah, I guess so.
And so the police chief issued a general order to arrest, quote, all persons known to be perverts, uh-oh, including a known pedophile.
I love this, though. Just being like, all right, everybody you know who's a pervert?
Everyone.
Bring him in.
Do they just register as pervert?
But this was hard, is that you got a mixture of just normal people that are just homosexual, that at the time considered psychological disease. You have people that, I mean, like, what do we now know? Everyone's a pervert on some level.
Absolutely.
Everybody's
sure,
got
yeah.
something. There's something at the core
something
of somebody that you really necessarily like. If you told everybody every thought you ever had, they'd consider you some kind of unrepentant pervert that needs to be put in a jail, right?
Well, people do that now, though. They do that.
Yeah, I know that. Yes,
it's their whole day.
No, no, it's literally what's destroying society and what's going to end the entire world.
What do women want?
they want a dress with pockets.
Oh, there we go. There we go.
But to the state's attorney's credit, he didn't think pedophilia had anything to do with it. He correctly surmised that if it was just about sex, the guilty party or parties wouldn't have overcomplicated things with letters and chauffeurs and so on and so forth.
Mm.
Rather, he figured that it was, of course, a kidnapping gone wrong.
Well, he also doesn't have what we now have with the decades of true crime research. If you find out a lot of the reason why the people do all of that rigmarole, the letters and ransom stuff, is to extend their sexual fantasy. It actually is a part of their sexual fantasy. But this kid just wasn't straight up sexually assaulted for them to easily point at it.
Yeah. And then Crow then pivoted, perhaps quite cleverly as far as obtaining resources went, to say that the kidnappers were also cokeheads.
Wait, why?
Yeah, because with this, he was able to bring in the newly minted Bureau of Investigation to help out.
You see,
if you
all
got
you
narcotics
do.
Involved, you
That's
got
it.
The FBI.
It's that Chappelle show thing. You just got to sprinkle some crack.
You just
got to go over there. You go right up to the little kid. You put a little cocaine under his nose and be like, this is a cartel. We're going to have to bring Rico into this.
Okay.
Now, there was no evidence whatsoever for the involvement of cocaine, but there was one piece of very valuable evidence the police didn't even know they had yet. That piece was the tortoiseshell eyeglasses belonging to Nathan Leopold that had been dropped at the scene where Bobby's body was dumped. Now, incredibly, the eyeglasses were just assumed to belong to Bobby Franks because they were found next to the body. So when they shipped his corpse to the funeral home, the glasses were included. And the funeral home actually put Nathan Leopold's glasses on Bobby Franks' corpse for the viewing.
Yeah, my God. Just so that he can see in heaven.
Yeah, what's the point, even if they were his glasses?
It's nice. It's nice because you say, because also what we know about the glasses is they were extremely expensive.
Right. Yeah, tortoiseshell. But when the family walked in for the wake, they very quickly asked, why did you put these weird glasses on my son? So the glasses were handed over to the police as an obviously key piece of evidence, and news of the glasses immediately broke in the papers. Now, by this point, Leopold and Loeb knew that they were getting real close to fucked.
Yeah, man. And this is rich boy style fucked, right?
Right.
So they're sitting in their mom's parlor house smoking cigars or doing whatever they do, drinking snifters of brandy and just being like, I don't think we're going to make it to the Potomac Summer Gala this year.
No, I think it's probably going to hit pretty hard when they realize they're totally screwed.
So they came up with an alibi in which they would vouch for each other no matter how much the police pressured them. They would become each other's alibi.
I was inside of Loeb.
There's no way I could be there. And he was inside of me. And honestly, it was incredible because I was the pitta and he was the halal.
Oh, isn't that nice?
Nathan, meanwhile, destroyed the typewriter used to write the ransom letter and threw the pieces in the river. In two different parts of the river, by the way. The keys in one part, the mechanics in the other.
You go in the river.
You're going in the other river.
You go in the other river. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Have a cry.
Nice.
But nevertheless, on May 29th, police still arrived at Nathan Leopold's door as part of routine questioning. Now, through a series of interviews with different folk, it was discovered that Nathan Leopold often went to Wolf Lake on ornithology excursions. And he sometimes took groups of students from the Harvard School of Boys with him.
You can't yell, you can't laugh at the ornithology people, the bird watchers.
Sure.
Because all they do is watch.
They do. And I love birds. I mean, they scare me, but.
And because they're so good at following little tiny things like birds, you don't think how easy it would be for them to track down a 6'7" Bud Light warbler.
Go down the Bud Light warbler.
Find him, put you in a fucking, can't wait to put a net over your head and they pin you to a fucking wall like a butterfly.
No, I'm much bigger than a dove. I'm much larger than a butterfly. I'm actually not scared of ornithologists at all.
But a gun makes us all the size of birds.
No, but they don't shoot guns. They take pictures of the
bird. You don't know what they do.
They do. They do. Nathan Leopold absolutely shot the birds.
Oh, you would shoot the birds? I thought most ornithologists
did not shoot birds. The weak ones just go and fucking take pictures of
them. Yeah, that's what you're supposed to do.
The real ones blow their fucking little heads off.
No, that's not an ornithologist then. That's a pornithologist. That's disgusting there. Also, pornithology, one of the hotter
you're just rambling.
Wing beasts.
You're just rambling to himself.
It was also noted that Nathan owned a pair of tortoiseshell eyeglasses. However, when police knocked on Nathan's door that day, he was not considered a serious suspect. Rather, he was just the next door to knock, and nobody knew that they were about to bust this case wide open.
Because that's the thing, too, is you go in, you really think you're just covering your bases. We're like, all right, we'll talk to these fucking rich kids, probably get some snifter of brandy out of it or whatever. And then you know that he was just so, he's such a little twerp. That thing about a lot of these fucking little twerpy fuckers, all these fucking the most excellent gentleman.
Elliot Rodger.
Elliot Rodger, like all these guys, like these fucking. As soon as you put the screws to them, they fall apart.
Absolutely,
none of them can handle the heat.
Now Nathan was predictably haughty with the three officers who showed up on his doorstep and demanded to see their credentials.
Badges, buttholes. Badges,
buttholes.
Based partly on his attitude, police brought Nathan to the Hotel LaSalle for questioning, where state's attorney Robert Crow was waiting.
Excellent. I love their deviled eggs.
Indeed. And as
the most evil breakfast.
As an ornithologist, he probably likes Detective Crow.
Oh, well, yeah. You probably shoot him in the head.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, the focal point of the questioning quickly became the eyeglasses. But Nathan insisted that his tortoiseshell eyeglasses were somewhere at home.
I'm not their keeper.
I mean,
they don't rule on their own. So. No, I won't dare ever because everyone has their own will to power. Now, let me explain for the next 4 hours what that means.
Okay.
So Nathan took the cops back to his place and made a big show of looking for his eyeglasses.
You know what's important sometimes with these glasses? You have to surprise them. They won't show themselves. Are you over there? Under the rock.
But when the case for the glasses was found empty, Leopold was held on suspicion and his home was searched. And amongst many a stuffed bird, police found a Remington revolver with no permit. But even more suspicious was a letter that Nathan Leopold had written to Richard Loeb but hadn't sent. In the letter, Nathan angrily accused Richard of treachery and threatened to kill him, but at the same time insisted that they remain friends for appearance's sake. But Nathan did say that if they ended their friendship, they had to be careful. His argument was thus.
The motif of the falling out of cocksuckers was sure to be popular, which is patently undesirable, and forms an unknown but unavoidable bond between us.
Good Lord, man. It's so intense.
He is very intense. The sentence that actually talked about how he was going to kill them is also really interesting because it shows their relationship was also very, how do you put it? Volatile.
Yeah.
Even throughout all of this time period, like they had gotten back together and they were working out. But again, Richard Loeb was just taking the shaft
as it's also said,
sure.
Or probably giving. He was giving the shaft.
Giving I would it. Say so.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But he was only doing that out of just kind of like an appearances and to keep this worm in play, right? Because now, especially that they've committed a crime together, they have to be a unified front. Back scuttlers unite.
Right.
But Nathan Leopold truly was obsessed with Loeb and it annoyed the living fuck out of him. But in a way, Nathan Leopold was the kind of always balanced between who was the more dangerous one. Because think about mm-hmm. this. He wrote this in a letter but didn't send him. Imagine if you found this letter in my house. If you found me saying this about Kissel.
Okay.
When you came to my home this afternoon, I expected either to break friendship with you or attempt to kill you.
I
unless
can see you
told
that.
Me why you acted as you did yesterday. Saying how dare talk shit about my organ meat.
No, I could actually see you saying something like that in a more Polish way.
Yeah, yeah, but you know what I mean? Like, yeah. It is, they were always, they were kind of on the verge of killing each
but
other.
But it seems mm-hmm. like that was part of the charm, huh?
I don't think that Nathan Leopold held a lot of charm for Richard Loeb. Richard Loeb was using Nathan Leopold, but Leopold liked getting the globes.
Okay.
Yeah. And and Leopold also liked this. Of course, it was all the king-slave relationship. Yes. He liked the push and pull of it. So and I think it was... I think the volatility was part of, as you say, the charm of their relationship. I think it kept him coming back because who else is going to give him that sort of oomph, that sort of danger, you know?
That push, right. That shove, yeah. That stuffing.
I see what you're saying.
And so Richard Loeb was brought in for interrogation as well, not just because they were in a sexual relationship of some kind, but because there was something obviously fishy and sinister about their relationship.
Listen, I'm just going to put it down here, and this is real simple, all right? The reason why we're bringing you in this interrogation room is because you're rich, gay, and evil. And we just want to look at it. We just need to look at it real close because you scared the shit out of me.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean?
I understand, yeah.
But before Richard showed up, Nathan did finally admit that the glasses found at Wolf Lake were his.
Yes.
Uh-oh.
He remembered. He had fallen down during his last birding trip next to the drainage pipe. Yes. Yes, it was next to the drainage pipe.
Oh, okay. Well, that's, yes. Oh,
and yes,
oh,
yes. They, and yes, they had to have fallen out of my pocket then. They had to. That
it
had to have been what
happened. Oh, it was a goof.
It was a goof.
I'm thinking of the scene from Mr. Bean.
How many times have you dropped glasses near a corpse?
Oh.
It happens so long.
Anytime I'm near a corpse.
Anytime you're near a corpse. Okay.
This was supposed a week before. This is a week before he would. He just happened to be near the drainage.
I haven't seen a thing in 9 days.
Oh, okay.
I've just been wandering around,
yeah, that's
grabbing services.
Right.
Just wondering what things are. What food? Is this food or is this shit?
Those are my breasts. Can you please stop groping
so,
me?
I need my glasses.
Yes, I know.
So to test this claim, with the actual murder evidence, by the way, state's attorney Crow had Nathan put the glasses in his jacket and take a few pratfalls to see if the glasses fell out.
Okay, now I can do this. Okay,
okay, ready? And action.
Hold on. Let me just get into character. Okay, right. Now think about this, all right? There's dirt there. There's dirt everywhere.
Drainage pipe.
Right? Yep. I see a pair of shoes hanging out of the drainage pipe, and I go, oh, what
it's
a
windy.
Lucky pipe. It just went shopping. And then,
what kind of bird is that?
The roughneck tickler.
Okay, the roughneck tickler. Okay, good,
yes,
good.
And I can tell just because it went. You
okay.
See, are you impressed, Mr. Crow?
I
Dr. Crow?
Little...
What are you? And now I'll show you, just set the scene.
Okay.
Still awake, it could fall out of my pocket. Let's do it again.
Okay.
Making the wind up extra long.
Yeah, really doing good. And fall down. This
simply, it might as well. Oh, this is.
They're kind of still in there, though.
Yeah.
I was covered in jelly.
Oh, that explains it.
Yeah. After a couple of tries, the glasses indeed stayed in his pocket.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And this isn't a hotel. This is a lobby.
This is the dumbest detective work I have ever heard, but okay.
I just love this idea. It's a bunch of people just watching fucking Mr. Magoo act in the lobby of a hotel, and they're like, this is the perfect crowd.
Now, Leopold and Loeb were both questioned separately at the same time about their alibis, and they corroborated each other exactly concerning how they spent their day about town in Chicago. Using Nathan's car as transportation between locations, they had luncheon. They saw a bird.
They saw a bird. And you know how long that takes? Yeah, it's a whole afternoon. Yeah.
It was a heron. They saw a heron.
You see the heron?
That's exciting.
Nice. Wow.
They somehow spent 6 hours in the park. Mm. They had some drinks at a bar. They tried to pick up a couple of girls named May and Edna. Then they went home.
I do love the fact that at some point, May and Edna were young.
Yeah. Yeah, they were.
I can't picture it.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. At one point, yeah, Edna was 19. Think about that.
Yeah, wow. Edna.
Yeah.
19 years stout.
Absolutely. Strong woman.
Now, this was a pretty normal day for a couple of gadabouts like Leopold and Loeb.
Yeah, they got nothing to do all fucking day but spend their parents' money.
Right.
But what didn't add up for State's Attorney Crow was the claim that they tried to pick up girls. Because from Nathan's letter, it was obvious that they were, in effect, dating each other.
Well, and they, gay men never take beards.
Wow.
They never
take, not at all. Not in Hollywood.
Hugh Jackman loves that 65-year-old woman he's with. He absolutely loves going down on her.
I think that Hugh Jackman loves the theater.
He does. So that's what he's married to.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I think that's true.
So Nathan and Richard were kept in custody for the time being while a mountain of easily obtainable evidence piled up around them. They matched the handwriting on the ransom note envelope to Nathan's handwriting.
Perfect crime.
Perfect. Perfect. Nailed it.
And they perfectly matched Nathan's typed legal notes with the typed ransom letter. Obviously done on the same typewriter.
Perfect. That's great. Perfect amount of evidence to get you for the perfect crime.
In an era where it was exceptionally easy to get away with murder, they magically found a way to give them so much evidence.
If they had just kept the body and didn't dump it, they would have gotten the money and they could have figured out a bunch of shit. Because, well, we know, nobody, no crime.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody, no crime. Kind of a fun Bob. It Bob is, Marley it's a, and it's the a, Wailers.
It's a bit of a parody.
It's a parody.
But perhaps the most unbelievable moment of hubris and arrogance in this entire saga came not from Leopold and Loeb, but their families.
Yeah, where do you think they got it from?
That's true.
They were so convinced that their sons were not capable of such a heinous crime that they didn't call a lawyer for 3 days.
Oh, yeah. Morons.
Nor did they prevent their sons from speaking to the police at all.
And in a way, I think that Leopold and Loeb felt invulnerable. They felt like that there was just like, yes, the evidence was mounting up, but we'll get into it in next episode. Their continued behavior will always show that they always kind of felt all of this eventually will go away.
Right, because everything else had gone away their whole lives. Oh, yes.
It's the whole narcissist thing, where it's the Casey Anthony thing. If I just keep lying, eventually the magic will become the magical thinking. Is that what they call it?
I think it's magical thinking. It's that idea. Yeah, exactly. If I just never give in an inch to your storyline, it makes my storyline real.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Casey ever mumbles under her breath, "Yeah, I did it," like at the bar, like 2 a.m. in Tampa?
I'm certain if you were in Fort Lauderdale, you've heard her full confession. Two times a week.
Yeah.
You just have to be there. You have to be O'Flanagan's, whatever her garbage bar she goes to.
Something like that.
Live from your grave.
Hey, what's up, everyone? How you doing? Ben Kissel here with Henry Zebrowski.
Yeah, it's me, man.
Yeah, bro. Henry Zebrowski is smoking some of that sweet last podcast on the left, babe. So go out there and purchase yourself some. I hope you enjoy it. We have sativa, we have indica, and we have a hybrid. And I have to tell you, from my personal experience, they are wonderful.
Super tasty live resin. You really get the delicious, weedy taste, which is what I like. And three different experiences. You go to your local vape store and get it.
Absolutely. Thank you all so much for supporting the show. We absolutely love you. Can't wait to see you on the road and get that vape, put it in your brain, and have a good time.
And if you want us at your favorite weed store, give them a call and ask for them by name.
Absolutely.
Last podcast on the left, it's weed.
Hail yourselves, everyone.
Hail Satan.
Now, concerning the typewriter, Leopold tried saying that it belonged to his friend Morris Schanberg. But when that was proved to be a lie, Nathan said that it actually belonged to an Italian language professor that Nathan was collaborating with.
Whatever.
Okay.
Nathan claimed that he and this professor were working on a translation of a 15th century pornographic novel called Radio Damante.
Yeah, perfect. Come, come, my daughter. Come, come on my daughter. Oh, come
wow.
in the
I love it. I thought it meant breadsticks and buttholes.
Really on the mente.
Very and nice.
That, yeah, it was a book that it featured a graphic conversation between two sex workers on the finer points of their profession, a new one and an old one.
Why do pretentious nerds always translate old sex books?
Yeah, they really do. And this, they were only translating it. They were supposedly translating it for a small run of 200 copies.
I just don't really understand. They're always obsessed with these things. It was like translations and all stuff. Who cares? Why do we do this? Garfield is better. Garfield is good.
Garfield's fine.
Other things are better. Batman.
Marmaduke. Penthouse Forum's better. You don't have to be intellectual about jerking off. You can just do it, man.
No, I used to jerk off with Penthouse Forums. That was some of the first things I ever read.
Know,
but it is good. More intellectual than looking at pictures with women with icicle dildos.
Wait a second. You're just about to start heading in. You start to head into the territory where incels say that having sex with a woman is gay.
Why?
Because you have to then, you have to dare touch a vagina.
No, I know. I just said I was reading a lot of hardcore pornographic materials in the Penthouse Forums and the letters were fun.
Yeah, they were. But
you said it was superior. You said it was superior to pictures.
No, I didn't say it was superior.
He said it was more intellectual. It was he did not say it was superior. He says intellectual. And
it is more intellectual. You have to make it up in your head.
A Penthouse Forum is not good writing, though. It's not high literature.
No.
Fucking came every time.
So did I, but it's not high literature.
So it was better than if it wasn't good. If you were a bad erotica where it's like, and then she
I'll get you.
Yeah.
And I ripped open her milk woman outfit because she's some kind of milk woman. And I pressed her down and I said, oh, time to make you a mother.
Well, I'm starting to think this mailman doesn't even have any mail on him.
No, it's no irradiamento. It's not that.
But that's a lie.
Yeah, that's a lie. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, Nathan said, you know, it'd be great if you could ask this guy. It could be great if you asked this professor.
We'd love to talk to this fancy pervert you're working with.
Unfortunately, he's on an extended honeymoon. Can't talk to him. Not going to be back for a while. Don't know when he's going to be back. So, you know, who knows?
Fact-finding mission. Okay. Yep. Yeah, to go find out the top gnocchis of Italy. So,
I see.
And then he's going to come back with the typewriter, too, because he took that on vacation with him.
You always take a typewriter.
Yeah, always
with you.
Do.
Always. Yeah.
Now, after Leopold had been in custody for about a day and a half, his family tried thinking of a way they could help him out.
What can we do?
And it was the family chauffeur, Sven Englund, who thought that he held the key to Nathan's freedom. Sven went to the police and told them that Nathan couldn't have driven to Wolf Lake on May 21st because Sven had spent all day greasing the brakes on Nathan's car.
Buckets of grease. You can see my grease-stained knees.
I love you, Sven. But technically, this was the smartest thing that they did thus far.
So
they gave themselves a little bit of a... We couldn't have been there.
I mean...
He was fixing the car.
He got ripped apart.
Well, yeah, okay.
Well, here's the thing, is that Leopold and Loeb didn't know that Sven Englund was going to go talk to the cops. This is Leopold and Loeb's family saying, God, yes, Sven, yes, go tell them. This is going to exonerate them. They thought that Nathan's going to be home in time for dinner.
Oh.
But with that single statement, Sven Englund gave the police everything they needed to fucking destroy Leopold and Loeb's alibi.
Perfect crime.
Because they had told police that they'd used Leopold's car on their frolic through Chicago on the day Bobby Franks was murdered.
We wouldn't use any other car.
Oh, God.
That is our bird car. We go and we see a bird in that car every other fourth Sunday.
This isn't Sven's fault, though.
No, it's not Sven's fault, but it is in Swedish, it's what's called a fort.
Oh, that means a big old fuck up?
That means a big fuck up. Yeah, that's a mistake. It's a fault. But even though there was a lot of evidence pinning the crime on Leopold and Loeb, it's important to remember that they were both extremely rich and therefore theoretically capable of buying their way out of a murder charge.
Mm.
So State's Attorney Crow pushed for a confession to seal the deal. Now, Nathan and Richard held up for a few hours once the cops put on the full court press. Mm-hmm. But while Crow was taking a break, his very Italian assistant, Johnny Sbarbaro,
Johnny, got a little pepperoni on your face.
That's my birthmark.
That's your birthmark? Oh, wow.
Johnny Sbarbaro came out and said that Loeb was ready to talk. Now, Loeb walked back his willingness to squeal when Crow came into the room.
Mm.
And Loeb asked, why am I being held here if you got no evidence against me?
Okay.
And to that, Crow told Richard about the eyeglasses and laid out just how badly their alibi had been shattered, all while Richard rocked back and forth in his chair.
Not good, not good. Gotta go to Kmart.
And finally, Richard broke and said he'd tell them everything.
Wow.
But predictably, Loeb placed the blame for the crime from beginning to end squarely on the shoulders of one Nathan Leopold.
Oh, he didn't own up to it and take responsibility and just say, yeah, I did. No, he didn't. Okay.
This is an excerpt from Richard Loeb's confession, which recounts the murder with chilling detachment.
Mm. I drove the car south on Ellis Avenue, parallel to where young Franks was, and I told him I would like to talk to him about a tennis racket. So we got in the car. And just after we turned off Ellis Avenue, Leopold reached his arm around young Franks, grabbed his mouth, and hit him over the head with the chisel. I believe he hit him several times. I do not know the exact number. Leopold grabbed Franks and carried him over the back of the front seat and threw him on a rug in the car. He then took one of the rags and gagged him by sticking it down his throat. The scheme for etherizing him originated through Leopold, who evidently has some knowledge of such things. And he said that that would be the easiest way, putting to death, and the least messy. This, however, we found unnecessary, because that boy was quite dead when we took him there. We knew he was dead by the fact that rigor mortis had set in, and also by his eyes. And then when at that same time we poured this hydrochloric acid over him, we noticed no tremor, not a single tremor in his body. Therefore, we were sure he was dead.
Y'all want some pizza?
Pizza?
Can we get some deep dish for lunch? So he really went into great detail there. Yeah. Sounded super cold and super callous. And I don't even necessarily think that he did himself any favors blaming it on the other fellow there, because he sounds like he was the one driving the car.
It's going right back the other way, too.
Yeah. Now, after laying out his tale, Loeb then covered his own ass further by saying that while he offered no excuse for his participation, he still offered an excuse, saying that he was fully convinced that the idea wouldn't have occurred to him had it not been for Nathan Leopold.
Yeah, but you could have just said no.
And yeah, I mean, you could have done anything. Yeah, you literally could have just said, like, why don't we just, like, not do that?
You have an idea. Yeah. We always have, all three of us have ideas all the time, and then one of us would be like, nah, that's not a good idea.
Like, let's do this. Move on. Yeah.
Well, this, of course, was total bullshit, because the whole thing had been Richard Loeb's idea. And it's almost certain that Loeb was the one who killed Bobby Franks while Leopold drove the car. But about half an hour after Richard was done, Nathan asked to speak to Robert Crow.
Can I speak? Can I maybe give a little bit of a...
You know that's really stupid, right?
Yes, but I want to be the one being stupid.
Okay, great.
And Nathan, convinced he was still playing some sort of ubermensch game of mental chess, asked Crow a hypothetical. He asked, quote,
all Freddy Nacho's is bullshit is all rhetorical statements, right? It's all just been like, maybe... Maybe it's like this.
I hate it.
Maybe there's something like that.
That's so creative. Yeah. Wow. If I did it.
Freddy Nachos is creative. I've been reading more of it. It is interesting. But yes, it's still very much like, what if something, what if there was? And I'm certain about it. But what if there? Suppose that someone from a wealthy family, a family as rich as his own, had committed this murder.
So like you.
No. Suppose someone from a family.
So it's like a fantasy that I'm going to have, but it seems really similar to you.
You could say many things are similar to me, yes.
Great.
What chance would that person have of beating the murder charge? Like, would they, if he was super rich and
if
powerful?
It was you, if it would it be like you or you?
Let's say it's a rat-faced, slick-backed old, but yeah. He'll suck your dick like he's sucking the chrome off a fucking new car. Yeah, so that's what I'm saying, man. maybe.
None. No, the answer is none. You have no chance.
I was hoping for the opposite.
Yeah.
And to that, Robert Crow delivered the line of a lifetime. He told Nathan, you're about to find out.
Whoa!
Because you're getting charged with the murder of Bobby Franks.
Woo!
Yes.
No!
The crow has come for me.
Yes.
Then when Nathan smiled and said there was no hard evidence against him, mm-hmm. Crow laid out the type of spiel that I'm sure every detective in existence dreams of making. He asked Nathan, "You remember waiting around to find a boy to kidnap? You remember the hot dogs and root beer you had after you killed Bobby? Tell me, Nathan, was it hard to shove Bobby in the pipe? You still think you can beat this murder charge?"
Ooh, that's awesome. And then he ate a bunch of sesame seeds because he's a bird.
Bernie Nachos, come and save me with the rhetorical, philosophical droning on about things that we can do nothing about, and it changes nothing about our day-to-day existence.
It's a great day to be a crow.
And after that, Nathan stopped smiling and stoically said, quote,
"Dick is talking. I will tell you the truth about the matter."
And of course, Nathan pretty much gave the same story as Richard, except in this version, Loeb was the one who murdered Bobby Frank.
Believe that.
It's the other guy. That's no crazy. Fucking way.
I guess that they're both innocent.
You both can't have done it, so must have been a snowman. Some kind of magical snowman with a hat on. And that's why we didn't see him, because he took the hat off of me, melted into a bunch of water.
Oh, I see.
Now, after they both confessed, before anyone had even called a lawyer, by the way, Robert Crow took them out and had them physically walk him through the day of the murder to make absolutely sure that the confession would hold up in court.
So first thing I did is I woke up like this. Oh. Okay. And then I went to get my breakfast, and here's the sound. And I poured the milk on the cereal. Glug, 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 glug,
glug. Yada, yada, yada.
Can I do the pratfalls again?
Not yet, but maybe by the drain where you left that boy.
You made it sad. I was having fun.
It is sad.
First, they went to the rental car company, where the manager recognized Nathan immediately, although the manager knew him as Mort Ballard.
That little gay fuck, Mort Ballard.
I can just see all of this in black and white with the term reenactment in the lower right-hand corner. They're just like looking at it and be like, oh, I see. We're really setting ourselves up here.
Then they were taken to the hardware store, where it was confirmed that Leopold had bought a rope and chisel. Finally, they went to the drugstore, where the clerk confirmed that Leopold had not only bought hydrochloric acid and ether on the day of the murder.
Great.
But he'd bought the largest amount of either that the clerk had ever sold.
Just, not only will I take that barrel, I'll take everything you got.
Woo! Great day to be a hardware store employee.
You want a lot of acid.
Yeah, you do.
Now, after both boys confessed, Crow announced to reporters that Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb had kidnapped and killed Bobby Frank's, quote, out of a spirit of adventure, which is a mild way of putting it.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, isn't that the name from
the
movie?
It's literally from the
spirit of adventure.
Yeah, that's me like going to get ice cream on a Wednesday.
Spirit of adventure.
Oh, I'm just having a fun day, you know?
Wow.
And then to make triple sure that the confession would stick, Crow made sure that the press had direct access to Leopold and Loeb. And Leopold and Loeb talked to the press incessantly, the opportunity to both toot their own superiority horns and to pin the murder on each other in public.
Jeez.
For Nathan Leopold's part, any mention of Richard Loeb would throw him into a tantrum. Partly because Leopold saw Loeb's attempt to blame the murder completely on him as a betrayal of the king slave fantasy he so cherished.
You're the daddy, I'm the baby, you're supposed to do the daddy things, and I'm supposed to be doing the baby things.
Remember, but you blame me for the murder too, though, so...
It's because daddy's supposed to be the big bad. I'm supposed to be the fun little small bad who fucks the big bad.
Okay.
But at the same time, Nathan also used this public forum as a way to establish his own intellectual superiority over the plebeians who went about their daily lives as a lesser class than himself.
Oh. Well, you don't understand, Dogmeat. You didn't even try to read Thus Spake Zarathustra. You can't possibly understand the inner workings of humankind, that indecipherable book. You need a dictionary to read, but you can't understand. You don't understand anything because he read a book.
Sounds like every single meeting of any third party in America.
Nathan said that while he didn't commit the murder himself, his participation was that of an intellectual performing an experiment.
Oh, you were just there. You were just there to like document. And...
He wanted to experience the sensation of a murder and was justified in his curiosity, just as a 6-year-old boy is justified in pulling the wings off a fly if by doing so, he learns that without wings, The fly is helpless.
So isn't
it good? You didn't think that, you didn't fucking know that before?
Isn't it good that I killed that boy then?
Oh my God.
Isn't it a good thing? Because then when it comes down to it, you need me to do this esoteric research for you as a society. That is why I am the overman. Yeah. Because I understand that this is not about good nor evil. It transcends good and evil. It is my want to see the edges of humanity's experience.
I mean, you could have killed like an adult that, you know, had power or something like that.
That would have been hard.
Yeah.
That would have been hard and messy and hard.
Right.
God, I could only imagine how hard his former classmates rolled their fucking eyes when they read anything Nathan said in the newspapers.
Like, just shut your fucking mouth, you fuck. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Get your fucking head out of Freddy Nachos' ass.
But you know
he
what?
He was a sickly little boy who never left his home. All he did was hike. He didn't know anything.
But to be honest, this is a fun day. This is a fun Monday when you come back. Yes. Like, you guys hear the news? And then you have a lot of conversations with your friends.
Oh, of
like,
course.
We all knew what they were going to do with these assholes, of course.
Why true crime now?
Now, it seemed at this point that a plea of temporary insanity was unlikely because Richard and Nathan had planned the kidnapping of a boy and the disposal of the body for 7 months.
Jeez.
And they'd even established false identities to evade capture. In Illinois, they go with the McNaughton rule of insanity. The insanity plea is that you don't know the difference between right and wrong.
Yeah, you have to be like a jabbering person who's not aware of their current circumstances to be considered insane.
Quote, unquote, you've got to be like a living knife, you know, where you just believe I am knife. And to make absolutely sure, three psychiatrists were brought in to evaluate Leopold and Loeb, and neither of them were found to be suffering from the slightest sign of mental illness that might affect their sense of right and wrong.
Well, one of them definitely is being diagnosed with terminal bitch face, and the other one is definitely got a horrible case of being a fucking total asshole.
That's your official diagnosis?
Yes.
Okay.
But it was around this point, and maybe about 3 days before, that Richard Loeb's father, after the confession, figured that it might be a good time to call a lawyer.
Yeah, we need a lawyer.
A little bit late. That's just a little late. But
yeah, we need a lawyer.
Yeah, and basically Loeb just called up this lawyer and said, just don't let the boys hang. And because the Loeb family were so fantastically rich, they were able to hire the most famous criminal lawyer in the country.
Almost in the world.
Yes.
Wow.
So while this lawyer is now known most famously for his part in the so-called Scopes Monkey trial, back then, Clarence Darrow was known as the attorney for the damned.
Oh.
And that is where we'll pick back up for the conclusion of our story of Leopold and Loeb.
It is fascinating.
I have to say, it's never good when you have to call the attorney for the damned. Like, I don't want to be his client.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
The reason why they called him attorney of the damned, or attorney for the damned, is that he was famous for taking on cases in which the people were undoubtedly guilty.
He's like very good.
Because we'll get into him much more in the next episode, but he was a big proponent of the concept of mercy. And his entire agenda was overturning the death penalty. He thought the death penalty was unconstitutional, evil.
Hate the sin, love the sinner.
Yeah.
That's his kind of the core of his thing.
He's a fascinating and actually very good person. But yeah, we're getting to Clarence Darrow next week.
Yes. And we have a lot more to roll out. This is a really thick ass fucking story because the next one has even more rollout. I will say, I'll walk back a little bit of my Freddy Nachos hate. I do
Nietzsche.
I do believe Nietzsche. That some of his stuff that he wrote is very interesting. And it is, but like the eternal recurrence I've been reading a lot about because you're not supposed to be the worst idea impossible that we don't die, that when you die, you just live this life again and again and again. But again, it just shows that whatever Nathan Leopold did was a very surface reading of his shit and then just a teenager's understanding of what it's supposed
to
be.
You can learn a lot from Dr. Seuss. Absolutely.
Where the places will go.
He hated children. Famously hated children.
Is that right?
Yeah, cheated on his cancer-stricken wife.
Is that true?
Yes.
That's very true.
She committed suicide because she found out he was fucking somebody else when she was bedridden with cancer.
No kidding. Real John Edwards.
All right. This Saturday, we're finally here, Ryman Auditorium. We're coming to Nashville. Come on, check it out. We got a couple of tickets. Why don't you come and check out that LPN Country Jamboree? We're all going to be on town. We're going to be out there. We're going to be sucking. We're going to be fucking. We're going to
be won't
eating.
Be doing that. We'll be making people laugh. We're going to do a show. We'll make you laugh a little bit.
And go to momenthouse.com/LPOTL to buy a live stream ticket to watch it from the nudity of your own home.
That's right. We can't wait to see you all in Nashville at the Grand Ole Opry at the Ryman, now called the Ryman.
Now called the Ryman. And next week we got Tirana and Vancouver.
Yes, I can't wait to go to our neighbors to the north.
Yeah, and I learned today it was actually, it was never called the Grand Ole Opry. The Grand Ole Opry was merely the radio show that appeared at on the Ryman stage
fuck,
every
Marcus.
Saturday night.
Hey, Marcus, you know what's so funny is I don't give a fuck about what you just said.
Wow, I learned
Isn't
so
that
much about the Grand Ole Opry. I mean, that's the thing that we're doing
I
here
don't
this Saturday.
Give
we're doing a country.
A fuck about what you're saying right now. Yeah, isn't that amazing how I was just able to do that?
I would say, wow, the No Dogs in Space listeners probably gave a little bit of a fuck about what I was saying, but you know. let's just disagree on that one here.
His job is to correct you.
Yeah, exactly. If I were to say something about the Packers, I would imagine that you would probably come and say like, "Oh no, Bill Belichick! No, Bill Belichick actually was the one who got the touchdown in Super Bowl 94."
Yeah, I know something about the Packers. When Terry Iommi went to do the first ninth field goal ever in a third quarter crunch position,
he found out his wife
was pregnant, and he had to go back to the local hospital and deliver it himself.
Yeah, because I remember when Emmitt Smith was the quarterback for the Packers when they played.
Opry was the name of the show.
This is getting contentious.
No, Ricky Henderson was definitely my favorite wide receiver the Green Bay Packers ever had.
He was a baseball player. Yeah. Anyway, all right, everyone. Thank you all so much for listening. Hail yourselves.
Hail Satan.
Hail again.
Magustalations, everyone.
Hail me. And honestly, you know, do your reading, but don't let it consume you. You must be able to accept certain controversial ideas, see them, engage with them, and let them pass before they turn you into a little tiny fascist.
And take the little snippets of positivity and then put it together and then you can have a personality.
That's weird.
That's how you do it. You cobble together a personality.
Actually, it is interesting.
Yeah, all of us are just mirrors of our reality.
Well,
true. Sure.
You're scaring me.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors, you can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.